All right, well, let me go ahead and get started. I know that some other people will be joining us later. I keep hitting the admin button here so people can join us. Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. My name is Janice Bellucci. I'm the Executive Director of the Alliance. I'm also a board member and the founder of the organization. Oh, and in addition to that, I'm a civil rights attorney. So we come here every month, Chance and I, to give you information and that we can share with you. But just to, so people have a better understanding, Chance and I are not here to give you legal advice. Okay, that's not what we can do. It would not be to your advantage anyway if we gave you legal advice with other people listening and watching, because then there would be no attorney-client privilege. So again, we're not here to give you legal advice today, but we are here to give you share information with you, also so that you can ask us questions. Generic type questions, again, not questions about your specific circumstances. And of course, Chance and I are available at other times for a legal consultation. So I think that's enough of the introduction. And Chance, would you like to introduce yourself, sir?
My name is Chance Overstein. I am a president of the board of ACSOL, and I'm also a criminal defense attorney, also one who's very involved in issues regarding registrants. And I'm very happy to join you this morning along with Janice and get this meeting going.
Okay, welcome everybody. So before we talk about the more substantive topics, these are two things that are really important, and certainly when they happen in your life, they are substantive. So the first thing is about compliance checks, and I know that I keep getting calls about that. I think that Chance does as well. What is a compliance check? How can they do it? And what are the limits of a compliance check? So people, a compliance check, unfortunately, is allowed, authorized by law if you're on parole, probation, or supervised release. If you're not on parole, you're not on probation, and you're not on supervised release, they can still come to your door, but what they can do at your door is vastly different. So let's just talk about the people who are not on paper, okay? And by that, again, I mean somebody who's not on parole, not on probation, and not on supervised release. If the police show up at your front door, the fact is, you don't even have to answer your front door if you don't want to. Okay, just like everybody else. It's up to you whether or not you want to answer the front door. Some people basically, walk the front door, go take a bath, listen to some really heavy metal music, or whatever else, bake some cookies, whatever else that you want to do, you can in fact ignore them. The problem with ignoring them is that they might get louder, right? And so I know I've heard of stories anyway of people's, the four armed officers come to their front door with, and are banging loudly. And for people who live relatively close to their neighbors, certainly people who live in condos or apartment buildings and such, that your neighbors are going to notice. It's not by accident, by the way, that they're there making so much noise. Some of them are just, it's the reason that they're there, is to basically, I think, to embarrass you. But anyway, the question is whether or not you need to let them in the front door, and the answer is no. You never have to let them in your front door unless they say they have a warrant, right? And you can put a smile on your face and say quite civilly, politely, "Do you have a warrant? Just asking. My attorney said to ask you if you have a warrant." Okay. If they don't have a warrant, then they don't get to come in your house, with a few exceptions like hot pursuit and things like that. In other words, if somebody just came running into your house with a gun that was still smoking, then yeah, they have the right to come in your house. But for most people, they don't have a right to come in unless you're unless they have a search warrant. And why would we say, Chance and I and other lawyers too, be careful about letting them into your house? Because quite frankly, if they see anything that to them looks like probable cause that a crime has been committed or is being committed, et cetera, in fact, then that gives them a reason without a warrant to search your house. And of course, that is never a good idea, for whatever reason. So I don't, and I say that because I value my privacy, and I guess I'm assuming that you value your privacy as well. And if somebody came in and saw something that they thought might be illegal, I guess Chance, the bad old days or good old days, depending on how you look at it, if somebody had cigarette papers, on the coffee table in the family room. Oh my goodness. Well, in the bad old days, oh my God, that must mean you have marijuana somewhere, right? And then they would do a search for the marijuana. But many people, they rolled their own tobacco cigarettes. And so
the other thing is that they don't have to come in order to make those observations. They can do it from your front porch. They can do it through your window. If they see something in plain view or they smell something funky and it leads them to conclude that something's going on illegally, yeah, they can enter. And the fact that they can get to your doormat, puts them in a better position because they have the right to be there. So I think that the message here is that, you want to comply and you want to do it tactfully, but you want to use your head. And, however that is, be reasonable in what you do. If you don't feel like or don't want to come to the door, of course, that's always your option because this isn't a mandate that forces you to do anything. It's simply a system of monitoring, which, all the other things can be worked out in a reasonable way. No one's going to plow through your door if you don't answer it. But on the other hand, you don't want to set off a chain of events where you're going to get hassled by, your local agency. So, I think it's good to be tactful and it's also good to protect yourself. And in terms of protecting yourself, make sure not only that, just make sure that you don't give them cause to do anything that is crazy. And I think that's the message we're trying to convey here.
Thank you, Chance, for that. And so one of the things I often tell people is if you decide you're going to answer the door, step outside the door, close the door behind you. Because like Chance said, if there's something in plain view, that could trigger probable cause right then and there. So even if you lock yourself out of the house for a few minutes, you can usually find yourself a way to get back in, right? But once they see something, then they trigger the probable cause and they can come in and search your whole house. So we're just advising against that. And the next thing I wanted to talk about briefly is scams, because unfortunately the scammers seem to be pretty active this summer and they're calling people and basically saying, you didn't. One that seems to be really popular these days is, oh my goodness, we had a DNA sample and the DNA sample got lost, or we didn't ever get a DNA sample or whatever. You need to come in. There's a warrant for your arrest. It's usually there's a warrant for your arrest. And oh, by the way to solve this problem, they'll tell you, is to pay us money. Now, they don't say that right away, but they just say there's a warrant for your arrest. You're going to be brought in to the station. That should be enough to chill most people's blood, right? The last place you want to do is go into a police department. So our police station. So, but the fact is, if you let them keep talking, eventually what they're going to say is, we want you to pay us money and meet me in the parking lot of the sheriff's department, right? Don't meet me in the front door of the park of the sheriff's department or the police station. Instead, meet me in the parking lot. And a lot of times they know their local situation, and they will in fact tell you, or they'll choose a time, when they know that the office is closed, because they know what they're doing is illegal. Folks, the easiest thing to do when you hear a scam like that is just hang up on them. Okay, that's all you need to do is hang up, because they only have, it's like the television set, right? If there's something on TV that you find offensive, just turn off the TV. But a lot of people think for some reason they have to keep watching that program, or that they have to listen to everything this person says. You don't have to, just hang up. Chance, would you like to add something there?
Just that the key element here is that police never ask for money over the phone. I mean, that should tip you off right there. I've had calls like this in the last week. DNA calls, about posting bail and all the rest of these things. And, the key element is that, law enforcement doesn't ask you to drop money off at a kiosk in front of their agency. I mean, if law enforcement wants you, they know where to find you. They've got your address. They can round you up in a second and they can have you do exactly what they're calling you to do. And you know what? They'll never ask for money. It's not for them to ask for money. So when you get a call like that, and the key, and they want to keep you on the phone, and even though they sound like a police agency, just know that that's not how agencies work. And the other thing is, it's really interesting here, is when they call you, I had a person call me this last week and they were in a complete panic. And I said, did you hang up? And, I advised them to hang up and call the police agency they register at just to verify, because they needed some kind of verification. So they called me back and they said, this is legit. And I go, how come it's legit? And they said, well, you know, I called them and I go, what number did you call? The number they gave me. Who gave you? The one person on the phone. Well, of course, that's, you can't call them back and verify with them that this isn't a scam, you know, so, but you don't even have to do that. Don't even bother with that. If you've got the set of circumstances and they want money and they want you to deposit in the kiosk and they don't want you to get off the phone, hang up on them. Simply hang up.
It is. And folks, I know too that it gets very emotional. And if somebody called me up and said, oh my gosh, we're coming to pick you up, you know, because we have a warrant for your arrest. Yeah, that'd probably get my attention too. But then as Chance said, if anybody ever, ever asks you for money, you know, then it's not the police. You know, they're not perfect, the police, but they don't ask you for money. Okay. So, again, this is just two things we wanted to talk about real quickly. Compliance checks and such. Again, you know, make whatever decision that you want to here, but know what your rights are. So you do have a right under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, the federal Constitution, against unreasonable searches, right? And so that's what we're telling you about. And somebody coming into your house without a search warrant in most circumstances is an unreasonable search. Okay, the scams, again, hang up. It's just, if they can keep running that tape through, or the message through your brain, if you get a call like this, no matter how it sounds, how authentic it sounds, it's not. Just hang up. And I think some of these people must have been theater majors, right, in school, in high school or college or whatever. And some of them even have like background noise that kind of sounds like they're in a police department or a police station. It's not. They're scammers. They're just going to take your money. And Chance and I are aware of one person who paid the scammers $10,000. $10,000. And guess what? If you pay money to these scammers, you will not get it back. And I got a call after the person paid $10,000. I said, sorry, because there's no way to tell who these people are. And what happened with that person, by the way, again, this is with regard to a scam, is that they said, go buy a gift card. Then kept him on the phone the whole time. Go buy a gift card, read the numbers off the gift card, and kept saying, oh, those are not good numbers, valid numbers, until he had $10,000 worth of gift cards. And in fact, they were valid numbers. And he basically got scammed out of $10,000. So just hang up on them. That's our advice. All right. So we do have a number of substantive things to discuss today. The first thing I want to discuss is the SORNA regulations, because you know, Chance and I were both planning to be at the hearing this past Monday. The hearing was supposed to be on this motion for preliminary injunction on the SORNA regulations. And I know quite a few people have had some questions. So the new date for the hearing, by the way, is August 1st. So August 1st at 9 a.m., I believe, is when the hearing is scheduled. The judge probably has more than one motion to hear that morning, so it might not start at exactly 9 a.m., but I know Chance and I will be there bright in early that morning, and some other board members as well. But it's all, you know, the hearing is available to the public. It's open to the public. And guess what? You don't have to drive there. You can actually watch the hearing online. And so if you go to the Axel website, you'll see that we were able to get a link so that you can, in fact, watch the hearing in real time. I will tell you ahead of time, though, it's quite possible the judge won't make a decision that morning. The judge might just take the matter under submission and make a decision at a later time. But this hearing is really, really important, because what one judge says, one federal judge rules, can infect people throughout the entire country. And so if this judge were to grant this motion for preliminary injunction, it's possible it could stop the application or the effectiveness of all the SORNA regulations. And somebody just sent me an article this morning about somebody who just got violated under SORNA. I believe it was he didn't report that he was leaving the state. So why don't we take some questions now? If anybody has questions or comments about the SORNA hearing, I did see a hand go up earlier, but then the hand went back down. So maybe they thought better of it. You know, one of the things that I think that Chance and I and everybody would be interested in is if anybody has had any experience yet with these new SORNA regulations. And so I guess, you know, have you, when you went to register, you know, in the last, well, since January 7th of this year, has local law enforcement told you about SORNA regulations, that you have new rules that you haven't had to comply with in the past. You know, when you sign your annual registration form and you are initially in each paragraph, has anybody had an experience like that? Please put your hand up. If anybody has a question about this, the regulations or this litigation that's now pending, I will say that, you know, this lawsuit was filed by the Pacific Legal Foundation. It's our first experience with them. But the fact is that it's a nonprofit organization that's been around for about 50 years. They have more than 40 lawyers. I don't know about Chance, but I'm really jealous that he got 40 lawyers. Wow, that's awesome. And stuff. And they've taken 16 cases to the U.S. Supreme Court, Pacific Legal Foundation has, and they've won 14 of them. Okay, so they've got a great track record. They said they're committed to this all the way to the end. If it can go to the U.S. Supreme Court, they're going to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think they're quite an ally, a valuable ally for us to have. I don't see any questions. So Chance, is there anything you want to add before we move on?
No, just the fact that nobody's had an issue yet is a good and healthy sign of a very dormant regulation. But the other thing is that the response to this lawsuit, as far as the U.S. attorney goes, begins with the California dismissal. And I think it's so interesting because I've brought that up before in the analysis. Originally, Anthony Gonzalez, when he was the U.S. attorney, brought that up again after his analysis. It was brought up in the very last evaluation of California. And in that very last evaluation, I think it was in a footnote. I can't remember now, but what it is, it explained that it takes those who have received California dismissals out of the definition of SORNA because there's nothing punitive that attaches to that dismissal post dismissal. And so, it's interesting to see the U.S. attorney's analysis of that. And also other things she said, but other things she said, you know, in total, you know, we've seen before. We saw this in IML, you know, these are, you know, and it'd be interesting to see whether or not that's just like, hey, you know, don't worry about it. And that's their brief topical explanation, or they really are vested in saying that that's how they interpret the regulations. So this hearing is going to be interesting. To see if that develops, and I think everybody who's vested, at least in California, in one of these dismissals, ought to listen in and hear what they've got to say, because it will be fascinating.
So we have Martin, who's got his hand up here. Martin, do you have a question or comment here?
It's sort of both. I did want to share it. It's ironic that you did bring up the scam phone calls. I did receive a phone call from SORNA. I did make sure that I registered on my birthday back in January. And so, but the person who identified themselves as a sergeant did not leave a phone number. So I went online to find SORNA's phone number and email, and I emailed them and I called them and left a message, and I have not heard back from them yet. But I thought I would share that.
What state are you in?
I'm in California,
and
Los Angeles.
Are you a state? Is it for a state conviction?
It is, correct.
Yeah, right. Okay, so there's no sergeant for SORNA.
Right. That's what I assumed. Yes.
Yeah, that's a scam. Okay. Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Martin. Thank you. So, folks, people are out there. I sometimes wonder, and I have no evidence to back this up, but I wonder sometimes if the people who are running these scams are actually law enforcement officers who are not on duty. Because for one thing, they seem to have people's phone numbers, and your phone numbers are not posted on the Megan Saul website for the public to see. So just something I wonder about. Looks like we have another hand up. Douglas, I'm asking you to unmute yourself. Welcome, Douglas.
Thank you, Ms. Lookie. I had a question. Right now I'm in a lawsuit. I'm in Tennessee, and I'm suing underneath Doe versus Snyder and Doe versus Roush. And the judge has done everything she could to prevent me from litigating my case, and including transferring to another jurisdiction that does not have jurisdiction. Right now, I am going to the Supreme Court of Tennessee, and which has ruled the community supervision for life unconstitutional, but they're still putting me under CSL. My question is, can my parole officer completely ignore these cases and constantly tell me I can't work or live nowhere? I mean, literally, I cannot work or live nowhere, even outside of restriction zones. And they're constantly harassing me and my friends. And they just recently arrested me for a violation of SORNA, but they didn't specify the reason. When I went to court, the judge nor the prosecutor knew what I was being charged with. So it said, you know, and my best friend had just died, and her kids were my god kids. You know, I couldn't get custody, but I could still help them. And so I just pled underneath the Alpha plea, and the harassment continues. I mean, is there anything that I can do?
Well, Douglas, perhaps you missed a statement that I made at the beginning of the meeting. What you've just described is very personal to you. If you'd like to call me during the work week and we can talk about this, I would be willing to do that, but it's really not appropriate for this group meeting. It's being recorded, okay?
Okay, all right, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, we do have a question over the chat section, Chance, and it says, I don't have a mic or camera, but I have a question concerning SORNA. If you are relieved of registration requirements by California, are you still required to follow SORNA for things such as notifying authorities before leaving the country? Would you like to answer that?
Sure. If you're going to travel internationally, I think it's important to comply with SORNA because you're entering into SORNA's jurisdiction. Okay. And so, you know, the answer from a California standpoint, before all of this SORNA stuff, was that we're a non-SORNA state and we don't have to comply. But, you know, we've had the IML and now we have these rules and regulations. And if you look at the rules and regulations, it seems to me pretty apparent that if you leave California, whether you're going to travel domestically or international, but we're talking internationally here, SORNA is going to apply. And so to make sure you're not the first test case, because you could be looking at some pretty stark things not going away but coming back, like 10 years federal prison, I think the safest thing to do is to give 21 days notice. I think that ensures that you complied with your obligation, and I think you're good to go on that.
You know, Chance, I think the interesting thing's going to be if somebody attempts to do that, again, they've been relieved from the duty to register and they're going to leave the country. That was a precise question asked here. What happens if you go to the registration office and they won't, they say, so what, and throw it in the trash?
Yeah, that's a problem. And this is, and by the way, that's what this litigation with SORNA is all about. You know, and, you know, I personally feel as though those who have been relieved from the requirement to register in California are kind of frozen until these issues are worked out in this particular case. That's my feeling. But if I were going to travel, I'd make sure I did some compliance. And, you know, I would make real sure before I travel to speak to an attorney and get, you know, their point of view, especially one who's familiar with these issues, on whether travel is feasible at this point until these issues are resolved.
Okay, so we've got three questions now in the chat room. Number one, if your motion is approved on August 1st, would the requirement to notify before heading to Mexico apply? Well, it's not just Mexico. If you're going to leave the country, as Chance just said, the safe thing to do before you leave the country is to notify your registration office at least 21 days before you depart the country. So SORNA is not going to change that. I still think that you're not going to get into Mexico. At this point in time, unfortunately, Mexico has a tried and true record of turning registrants away, so especially if you fly from the United States directly to Mexico. The chances of you being allowed to enter Mexico are small. To zero. I've heard stories, and certainly I'm not making this recommendation. I'm just sharing a story that I've heard from multiple people, that they've been able to walk across the border. They've taken a taxi across the border, and many other ways that people have crossed from the United States into Mexico. But the fact is, you still have to come back. And when you come back, the question might be asked, how did you get there in the first place? So then, you know, did you give the 21-day notice? So the information that Chance and I are sharing with you is to try to minimize, never to eliminate, because it's impossible to eliminate risk, but to minimize risk. And why would you want to risk 10 years in federal prison, right, just to go to Mexico? I'm sorry, or anywhere else for that matter. So if I were that person, if I were in the registry, I wouldn't take that risk. But, you know, we're all individuals and we can take whatever risk we want to. You want to add to that, Chance?
Oh, no. No, I think that's pretty comprehensive.
Okay. Here's another question. Tier 1 for SORNA requires registration for 15 years, I believe. So how do you get relieved of SORNA obligations? You know, my understanding is it's automatic. So it's not like California's petitioning process, the tiered registry law. And if you're in a SORNA state and you make the minimum number of years, you're automatically removed. What do you think, Chance?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm a little confused here. And that's why I'm so eager to go to this hearing, because that's one of the issues that was brought up in this case. You know, and it was said that the petitioner may have already exhausted the years. Well, I'd like to know how the calculus goes. I'd like to know approximately how the government calculates when in fact SORNA's run out, and how that works, because California is different. I mean, when you talk about California and you talk about the tiered registry, if let's just say you're in California and you move out of California, wherever you move to, let's just say overseas, and you don't register for 5 years, then you want to come back to California and you want to get off the tier, but you only have 5 years in. Okay. You got to wait another 5 years before you petition, because clearly the petition and the government requires that you at least register 10 years before applying. Let's just say if you're in tier one. Okay. I'm not so sure if SORNA works like that. I'm not, because I really don't know. And so we might get a front seat as to how these things are calculated, so that we all understand it a lot better.
Yeah. So remember, folks, those of you who are from California, who live here in California, Chance and I are California attorneys, and California is not a SORNA state. So I've read the SORNA rules, and I think it says after 15 years, if you're on federal SORNA tier one, that you're to be relieved from the requirement to register. And it appears that it's automatic. But other than that, I can't give anybody any details. Though also, it appears that if you're tier one federal SORNA, you also can petition for removal after only 10 years on the federal tier one. But folks, I warn you, don't, you know, like, especially here in California, if you're a CP offender, you're probably a felony CP offender, you're on tier three. And just because SORNA says that's a tier one offense does not mean you're on tier one in California. So please tread carefully in that. And we'll be talking about the petitioning process here in a little bit, so I don't want to go any farther with that. But just understand there's definitely confusion out there. And Chance and I are trying to illuminate, shall we say, the issue, but it's confusing because it's confusing. Okay, next question. Under SORNA, do you have to report every time you leave your state, regardless of duration of absence, or just if the trip out of state is 7 or more days? Well, folks, according to these new SORNA regulations that took effect in January of this year, you could even be in the state and have to notify your registration office if you're going to be gone from your home for more than 7 days. So let's just say in California, you live in Southern California in sunny San Diego, and you decide you want to go visit the fog in San Francisco, and you want to be there for 10 days. Under these SORNA regulations, you're supposed to notify your registration office because you're going to be gone from home for more than 7 days. And it doesn't say, and leave the state. So this is one reason that, to me, the SORNA regulations, one of many reasons, these SORNA regulations did, in fact, need to be challenged. And I'm so grateful to the Pacific Legal Foundation that they are taking that challenge up.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the questions that you're asking are all good questions. And I think that this litigation is going to clear a lot of these questions up, because they're going to come out. These things have to come out. What I said just a moment ago may have been a little bit confusing, but what I was saying was, if you're relieved in California after, say, 10 years, and you've been relieved, let's just say that you got relieved 10 years ago. So now it's been 20, it's 10 years since you've been relieved and you did 10 years. Does that space and time count? I don't know, but we're going to find out what counts and what constitutes what, I think, because they're all relevant questions, and that all goes to the person who's petitioning in this case, is an excellent petitioner. And I just think that we're going to get some answers here.
Yeah. It's a really important case. This motion is also really important because of the potential impact it could have on everybody in the whole country. But I guess I want to reduce some expectations here. Federal judges do not like to issue injunctive relief in general. So it's quite possible that when the judge makes a decision here, will rule against the motion. But if that should happen, really nothing's been lost, I don't think, because it would just maintain the status quo. So right now the status quo is lots of uncertainty. If the judge rules against the motion for preliminary injunction, guess what? That uncertainty will continue.
Yeah, and just to really even clarify this even more, the questions I'm talking about have to do with the preliminary injunction. As for the case in general, I think it's a winning case. I mean, I do think it's clearly a separation of powers issue, a delegation of powers. So I think it's a winner, but I'm really focused on this preliminary injunction. And, again, federal judges are loath to do that, but, it's got to be pretty compelling when they do. This should be an interesting hearing.
And one reason that they're reluctant to issue injunctive relief is they know the potential impact of their decision. So, and people have asked me, well, how do you know that it would apply to everybody in the country? Well, all we have to do is think about that. Remember, there's a federal mandate to wear masks on airplanes. Remember, one federal judge, I think he was in Florida, said you don't have to wear masks. And people all over the country, including, I understand, some in some flights, the pilot got on and said, hey, guess what? You don't have to wear a mask anymore. And people on the flight, from point A to point B, took their mask off right during the flight. So so this could have a huge impact. But again, if the judge should rule against the motion, I don't think there's a big downside, because, in fact, it would just maintain the status quo. As much as Chance and I don't like the status quo, it wouldn't make things any worse than that. Okay, so let's move on, because we do want to talk about some other issues. We're going to talk about military, and thank you, Rafael, for the applause there. I'm not quite sure what exactly that was for, but
yeah, so just like moving on or something. Like, okay.
Oh, that's the hook. Get off stage. Change topic. All right. So let's talk about the military veterans for just a few minutes. And then we're going to talk about travel, because it's summertime and people want to travel. Oh, my goodness, if you're brave enough to travel on the airlines these days. So military veterans, we've gotten so many people who have contacted AXSAL, basically saying that they're military retirees. They did 20 plus years on active duty, and now they're a retiree. And now they're being denied access to military bases. I think it's a crying shame. I'm a veteran myself, and I made a decision not to make a career of it, but I respect people who do make the career of it. It's a big sacrifice, 20 plus years in the military. Some people did nothing more than sit at a desk for 20 plus years, but other people, really fought in combat and risked their lives. So to me, it's unconscionable that the government would just decide one day, which is what seems to have happened, just decide one day, oh, if you're on any registry in any state, we're not going to let you on base anymore. And we have people who are relying upon, the military for medical care. We have people who are relying, going to the grocery store, the commissary, people going to the exchange, like at a department store. And, the prices are lower in those places. And guess what? Retiree pay is not that great. So these are real live benefits that were promised to people a long time ago, and they were taken away without any due process whatsoever. And there's also people in the military that, they go from travel. It's not just like the local base that they're going to, but, when they travel cross country or something like that, or sometimes flying space available on flights. I know I did that when I was in the military. You could fly from, you know, many places for absolute free. It wasn't like being in a commercial airliner sometimes, but it was free. And you got from point A to point B. And so some people really relied on that in their retirement. And yet these things were taken away from them. So we have the case that's pending involved the Vandenberg Air Force Base, which is in Santa Barbara County. Actually, one of our foundation board members, he's 75 years old. You know, he was convicted of a sex offense, but it wasn't on a military base. It didn't involve anybody who was in the military. I mean, there's no connection to the military whatsoever. And by the way, it happened about 30 years ago. And so he is somebody who's relied on the military medical care for over 50 years because it started out when he was an ROTC. And so the first time, you know, he was denied access to Vandenberg Space Force Base. He's agreed to serve as a plaintiff, but we are possibly going to file another lawsuit over on the East Coast with somebody who is an Army veteran. So the first gentleman I referred to was an Air Force officer, and the second fellow was an enlisted person in the Army. And the second person, by the way, is I believe 100% disabled due to service injuries. And so I think he would make an even more sympathetic plaintiff. So just to let you know, that's going on. We filed the lawsuit on May 12th, and the military hasn't responded yet to the lawsuit. I think they're going to try to file a motion to dismiss this and say, well, the base commander has the authority to decide who, you know, he or she wants on the base. But even base commanders have a limit. They always have bosses. And so, you know, so we'll see what happens. And I know that I helped a gentleman in San Diego who was trying to get on a Navy base, and he's a cancer survivor, and he goes on this naval base to go get cancer treatments, right? And the base commander got caught by surprise, did not know this was going to happen. And so I was able to get him a pass to go onto base for his medical treatments. And if anything like that should happen to you or anybody you know, just have him refer them to me. Because there are some base commanders who have a heart and understand that they folks need medical treatments. Chance, is there anything you want to add before we move on to travel?
No, not at all. That was good. Good information.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Okay, so let's talk about travel, folks, because it is summertime. A lot more people travel during the summer than during the rest of the year. And there's some real pitfalls here. And Chance and I really want to help you not fall in one of these traps. So Chance, why don't you start? And you can start with domestic or international travel, whichever you prefer.
Yeah, we'll just start with domestic. Domestic travel, traveling from state to state, that's the issue that we're going to speak about right now. And basically, the rule of the road is, and the underlying thing you should understand, and let's just take those people from California, but it really pertains to anybody in any jurisdiction. Do not register in another jurisdiction other than the one that you're already registered in. I'll give you California for an example. If you do that, let's just say you register in Florida, but you're a California resident, and in California you are, like, say, tier one or say tier two, and you're eligible for relief. Even if you get relieved in California, you still remain on the registry because you never get off of it in Florida. And there are jurisdictions that are like that and some that are not. But you have to, when you're thinking about domestic travel, I think, consider that any other jurisdiction you register in might be like Florida and might cause you issues when finally you get free of this registry in your home state, let's just say California. So the rule of the road is avoid registering anywhere else. Now, in order to do that, you've got to set an itinerary. You've got to know what the rules of the road are in each state you go to. Some states give you 24 hours. Some states give you 48 hours to register, and some maybe 10 days. But you have to know exactly what that state requires and how long you should stay there before you leave it, before you're obligated to register. And I think that if you do that and you make plans, and let's just say you're traveling to several states, it's going to make your trip pleasant because you're not going to be stressed out because you're going to think that you're going to have to register in that particular state. And I think that overall, you're going to protect yourself, especially because you're not going to complicate your issues, in your home state with registration in other states. And so that's the thing to consider. That is the main rule to keep in mind when you're planning out your trip and you're traveling. Janice?
Yeah. And folks, we have information on the AXAW website about what the requirements are for visitors to other states. Please go look at that before you call me, please. I get a lot of calls about this question, especially in the summertime. Not that it answers all questions, but at least it gives you some guidance. And so on the homepage of the AXAW website, there's up on top, there's a link that says legal. And if you basically, you know, click the legal link one time, and there's a drop down menu, and the very first document is in fact a comprehensive list of all 50 states and Puerto Rico and Guam, I believe, that's got the information there, Virgin Islands. So it's got the information there. It's not always concise, and please don't rely solely upon the information on that, on our website, because it's a couple years old now. But the great thing about it is it has there the statute. It tells you what the statute is. You can look the statute up yourself. A lot of times that's what I do. I copy the statute that's listed on that, on the chart, and I just use that as a search term, and boom, you find the current law. And most of the time it's correct, but every once in a while something changes. Because I remember, like, Florida used to be, I think it used to be you could visit up to 5 days in Florida, and I believe it's down to two before you have to register. So again, what Chance is trying to help you prevent is from being registered in multiple states, because in fact, when it comes to things like the international Megan's Law and whether or not you're required to have a unique identifier added to your passport, if you're not registered in any state, guess what? You don't have to have the unique identifier on your passport. So, and for other reasons as well. Okay, so let's go to overseas travel, because that's always so much fun. because we've run slam, you know, right into this wall called the International Megan's Law. And I just mentioned unique identifiers being added to people's passport. There's really two main parts of International Megan's Law. Part one has to do with notification. Part two has to do with passports. So part one, it basically said that if in fact you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and it's the federal definition of minor, which means under the age of 18. So even if your state says 16 is legal, under the federal law, it's 18. Okay. So if your victim was under the age of 18, then you are required to notify the government that you're going to go overseas. And you're supposed to do that, give at least 21 days notice. Now, you know, we're not a sort of compliant state in California. Should we still do this? I always advise my clients to do it. If you're still required to register, go ahead and give the notice, at least 21 days notice. I often recommend you do 30 days notice in case people can't count very well. So, you know, you want to notify them that you're going to go overseas. And then guess what happens? The federal government receives that information, not directly, but you go to your registration office and say, hey, I'm going to go to France. Okay. 30 days from now, I'm going to France. Here's my flight information. Here's my, you know, where I'm going to stay, et cetera. Then what happens is your local registration office sends that information on to the federal government and directly to the Department of Homeland Security. Okay. And what DHS does with that information is then they turn around and they send a message to the country to which you're traveling. Okay. So when you wonder, well, how do they know, right, that I'm going to France? It's because the Department of Homeland Security has sent a notice to France telling them you're coming. Now, there are 26 countries in Europe that will welcome you to come visit. I'm not saying to move there permanently, but if you want to go visit France, Germany, Spain, or Italy, and 22 much smaller countries, guess what? They're going to welcome you. Okay. But there are other countries out there that are not going to welcome you. All right. And so the way our country gets away with this is they go, well, we're not telling you that you can't enter Japan. Japan is telling you that you can't enter Japan, right? But the fact is, Japan wouldn't necessarily know that you're coming, but for the fact that the federal government sent them a notice ahead of time. And what that message says, and paraphrasing, is this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. And to me, that is really, really vague language, right? A sex offense, Well, these days, public indecency, basically, you know, relieving yourself in an alleyway is a sex offense with a minor. They don't say what the age of this minor is, right? In some countries, the age of consent is 12. Okay, not 18, but 12. But the country that's receiving the message, of course, is going to interpret it in their own way. And it doesn't say anything in there about how long ago you were convicted of a sex offense. And I'm always using Frank Lindsay as an example. Frank Lindsay was convicted of one sex offense in 1979. This man has been registering for more than 40 years, right? And yet, somebody reading that message, this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, might very well assume he did it last year, right? So it's just too vague. And so because of that message, I believe, and I'm sure there's international ramifications here going on, because of that, many countries will not allow somebody on their registry to visit their country. Chance, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I see that someone said something in chat already about what I'm going to say, but
okay. You
know, invariably, every time we say this, invariably, we always get a question. Well, what if it's not with a minor? What if the complaining witness is what I generally call a victim in a criminal case? But what if the complaining victim or the complaining witness was not a minor? Well, then this doesn't apply to you. You don't fall within the jurisdiction and the definition of IML, and so you don't have to worry about this. You're not going to get a marker on your passport, nor are you going to be subject to the IML because it just isn't within the definition. And that seems pretty clear to me. Now, you know, I know that some people get confused on that, but remember, there are two elements in this particular case, which is it has to be a minor. So, you know, that's one. And two, and, you know, you have to be a registrant. And then IML kicks in the way that we're describing it.
Looks like we have a question. Rafael?
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you again for doing what you do. Very much appreciate it. I am a little confused, though, because, my complaining is not a minor. Does that mean that I don't need to do the 21 days notice? But I do know that I need to do the 21 days notice because of SORNA. Now, SORNA says that you release from SORNA after 15 years. And if I have 36 years from my conviction on the registry, does that still apply to us? And where does that 21 days come in relation to the SORNA and or the minor issue?
I think that's a good question for you, Chance, if you don't mind.
Yeah, that's a confusing question because we don't know. you read those regulations and it kind of gets blurry between IML and SORNA. I mean, and that's the issue here, is that we're in this big gray patch area. It's a cloudy area, and your confusion is our confusion. We just don't know. These issues are going to be worked out, and hopefully once this case is decided, maybe this issue will go away, and hopefully maybe it will never come back again. But it's a very, very good question. The question is forget IML. Does now these rules and regulations make it so that anybody entering into interstate commerce, you know, are subject to them? And especially those traveling internationally, do they have to do what SORNA requires? And that's a very good question.
There are a lot of good questions out there, folks. So if you have half a dozen of them running through your brain, don't be surprised. Okay, so I said there's two parts to IML. The second part has to do with passports. And so, I do want to make one clarification. When we are talking about a sex offense involving a minor, it doesn't have to be a hands-on offense. All right, so I'm sorry, but if you viewed child pornography, so that had to involve somebody under the age of 18, it also applies. The International Megan's Law does apply to you. Okay, so we talked about notice first. The second part is the passport. So what the passport provision says is if you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you are registered in any state in the United States, then you must have a unique identifier on your passport. And then it goes on to say that if you don't have a unique identifier in your passport can be revoked at any time. And I do mean at any time. I unfortunately had a client whose passport was revoked. So they said after the fact, he didn't know it had been revoked, and he was taken off a flight. He was already boarded the flight. His bag was already checked. Oh, by the way, his wife was already in the flight with him. Her bag was already checked as well. And they basically escorted him and her off the airplane. This is how it can be. So I used to say, don't get a unique identifier if you can avoid it. Now I say, go get a unique identifier added to your passport to prevent that from happening. So the wording of the unique identifier is very similar to the notice that's sent to the other country to which you're traveling, which is this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Again, I think it's very vague language, and I think that alone should have shot down international Megan's Law, but guess what? The judge didn't agree. So there's a unique identifier. I'm extra disturbed by the placement of the unique identifier now. Initially, the unique identifier was put in the back pages, one of the back pages of your passport. They're called the endorsement pages. I didn't even know they existed on my passport until this issue came up. And then I went and looked and I went, well, you know, I have endorsement pages. Nothing was on my endorsement pages, but that's where it was located, like page 27 or something of the passport. Unfortunately, in the last few months, people who are getting unique identifiers is being added to the very first page of your passport, not the outside cover, but the first page. So putting that is like, well, what is the first page? The page where your passport, where your photo is and your personal information is page 2. So it's before that page. So basically when you open up your passport, you're looking at the very beginning of your passport, it's on the first page. So I'm particularly incensed and upset about this because we were told during the litigation on the International Megan's Law that it was going to be put in an inconspicuous place. Page 1 of your passport is not inconspicuous. And so we are, in fact, considering a new challenge to the International Megan's Law based on the placement of the unique identifier. Chance.
Yeah, just to capsulize real quick where we are with all this. If a minor is involved and if you're a registrant, you know, you're looking at a unique identifier. Okay. However, the second question is, well, if it doesn't involve a minor, what shall I do? And the answer I think probably is, in order to pad your bets and to make sure that you're in compliance until we figure out what compliance actually means, you should do 21 days notice. That will cover you. So if you're going to travel, you don't have to refrain from traveling overseas. You know, do the 21 days notice until this issue is worked out. I think that's probably the safest way to travel today internationally.
And what I would add to that is when you, in fact, give that notice to your local registration office, take 2 copies of that notice with you and have them sign, date, timestamp, anything that one of the copies that you take with you. And then take that form with you on your travel. And when you get home, put it in a safe place for a while. Okay. Because what you don't want them to say, the federal government afterwards, is, hey, we didn't get any notice, because it's possible that your local registration office doesn't notify them, feds, right? And that should not be on you. You should not bear the responsibility for that. And so if you have some kind of proof, as Chance and I as litigators would say, some evidence, right, that you at least made an attempt to notify local registration, that should put you in a much better position. Okay, just a little bit more about overseas travel. There's a website out there that is doing a good job of reflecting registrants' experiences when they travel overseas. It's called the Registrant Travel Action Group. And I think I'll put I'll put their website address in the chat section today. And so you can go look at that, because folks, you're not going to get any advance notice. Okay. You could spend thousands of dollars on a ticket. You can spend 10, 12 hours getting to a country overseas only to be turned away. And I mean, what disaster that would be, right? And if you're traveling with other people, what? All of a sudden, they have to make a decision whether or not to go without you. And I've heard both things happen. I remember one man, he's traveling to the Middle East. He was stopped and said, no, we're not going to allow you to enter. And they were going there to visit the in-laws, as I recall. And so his wife and children went ahead with the visit. But as I told you, that other instance when, you know, a registrant and his wife were traveling overseas to Europe, by the way, and they were stopped. And she said, no, I'm not going to go without you. It was celebrating their 30th wedding anniversary. Can you imagine? Oh, yeah, I'm going to go to Europe without you to celebrate their 30th wedding anniversary. So it impacts not just you, of course. It impacts a lot of other people as well. And so if you go onto that website, you'll find out, for example, that most of Asia is off limits. I think the only place in Asia that registrants can visit right now is Hong Kong. And I know they have a lot of political unrest. Make your own decision on Hong Kong. But there are other places. And as I said, there's at least 26 nations in Europe that you can visit. And maybe if it's not your first choice, you know, at least you can see some good sights and eat some good food. Okay, so let's go ahead on to a couple of cases that are pending. So we've been busy filing lawsuits, and three of the lawsuits that I want, I'll mention in a minute, I have to do with the tiered registry law here in California. But before we get to that, I want to mention a couple of other cases. One of them is a case, and it's a personal case that I'm doing. It's not an Axol lawsuit, but I think you all need to know about it. There's a young man here in California. He was 18 years old in a couple of months when he was charged with rape. He was charged with raping one of his fellow high school students. And you're like, oh, I've heard this story so many times. You haven't. There's a twist to this one. So he was arrested for raping. He was 18 and she was 15, raping this woman. She alleged that she was raped, so I will call her a woman. But when they did a rape test kit and also physical exam of the alleged victim, there was no evidence, none, a physical evidence of a rape. None. And yet the public defender recommended that he plead guilty. Okay, an 18-year-old, and by the way, they kept him in jail, of course, the whole time, and for months before the public defender said, oh, yeah, she cries a lot on the stand. They'd done a preliminary hearing. She cries on the stand, so you should go ahead and plead guilty to a rape that didn't happen. So this is not the Brian Banks situation, right, where somebody did rape a female but it wasn't Brian Banks. The case that I'm talking about, there was no rape. And yet the public defender did recommend that he plead guilty to forcible rape. He did plead guilty because he didn't know better. Remember, he was 18 years old. Did I mention that he'd been in the foster system since age 4? Did I mention that he was a special ed student in high school? You know, I mean, he couldn't comprehend what was going on, but the public defender just did what they did anyway. Because he pled guilty to rape, he got, I don't know, somebody thinks it's a light sentence, some other people think it's not a light sentence. They basically said you have a 9-year sentence, and he was put on probation chance, is that right? And basically, if he messed up, he would be returned to prison. As it turned out, he didn't mess up. He was able to stay out of the system. But the fact is, he was on the sex offender registry for 23 years. 23 years. He's never gotten his high school diploma. He has had a terrible time trying to find any type of work. He was homeless much of the time. And so I filed a lawsuit against basically a legal malpractice lawsuit against the public defender. And guess what? The public defender is now a sitting judge. So I think that if I'm successful in this lawsuit, the judge will lose his license and will not be a judge. And I don't know the man. I don't know. I've never met him. I have no animus toward this judge. But the fact is, my concern is if he treated one person this way, he's treated other people this way as well. And so I just want to let you know about it. The man's name, by the way, is public lawsuit. So it's Jermaine Dickerson, and the county is Contra Costa County. We filed the lawsuit in federal court, because there's no way I was going to file this lawsuit in Contra Costa County. You know, basically one of his peers wanted to be reviewing the case, and I didn't think I could get a fair trial. Who knows what's going to happen in this case, but I think it's really, really important to represent people like Jermaine Dickerson. Again, an 18-year-old. And by the way, he's African-American, and the attorney was not. Okay, so let's go on. Another case that we have pending has to do with jurors and whether or not somebody convicted, whether or not somebody convicted of a sex offense could serve as a juror. And not everybody wants to be a juror, but some people do. And I believe that everybody should have the right to serve as a juror. And when our state legislature passed a law that said, hey, felons, you can now serve on juries, right? Because we used to have a jury exclusion as far as somebody convicted of a felony could not serve on a jury. That was the general rule. And it was in our state constitution even. So, you know, the good folks at ACLU and some other four-letter organizations said, hey, let's change that. Because what they found out was it's not possible to get a jury of your peers, right? When in fact your peers have been convicted of felonies and they're not allowed on juries. So what happened, though, in the legislative process is that one person who's no longer in the state assembly, by the way, she basically made the author, forced the author to add an amendment to the bill that said, unless you're convicted of a sex offense, right? So everybody else convicted of a felony, with a few other exceptions, like tampering with voting or something like that, you know, very specific. But anybody who's on the sex offender registry due to a felony conviction could not serve on a jury. So this case is pending on appeal. All the briefs have been filed in the case, and we're waiting for the appellate court's decision. The reason I think this is such an important case, maybe not even so much about whether or not you can serve on a jury, but it has to do with the legal claim, which is equal protection, right? So equal protection argument goes like this. Why is it that a person convicted of murder can serve on a jury, right? And they're not biased. Whereas a person convicted of a sex offense is considered biased and can't serve on a jury. And so if we can get a favorable ruling in this case on the equal protection claim, then we can use that as precedent in some other cases involving the tiered registry law. So do we have any questions about that, or anybody might want to make a comment like, there's no way in heck I ever want to be on a jury. I'm glad that I can't serve on a jury. Or how about the opposite? Is there anybody out there who really has a burning desire to serve on a jury? I guess not. Looking at the chat room there too. Okay.
Yeah, this is Scott. Yes, I actually have always found that was the worst thing to do. I live in the state of Maryland, and I think we also had that law where if you have any kind of felony, you cannot serve on a jury. I've served on juries before. I was convicted, and I just think it's a shame. So I really appreciate and commend what you're trying to do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that feedback. John's got his hand up too. John, I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Thanks, Janice, and good morning, everybody. Question with respect to being on a jury, if let's say you're successful and sex offenders can serve on a jury, that can pretty well get blown out of the water when one, let's say the prosecutor announces to everybody in the courtroom, well, we now have a convicted sex offender or former sex offender sitting on the jury. Would it be possible to suggest to the judge or even require the judge to require that or mandate that either any sex offenses be discussed in private with the or with the bench and not within earshot of everybody else? I mean, that would be a pretty stiff rule, but just a thought.
Yeah, Chance, I think you're better qualified to answer that question. You spend more time in front of juries than I do.
Well, that's not going to get in front of the jury because these delicate issues are discussed up at the bench. Now, I'm not saying that a jury won't be within earshot because, you know, sometimes prosecutors are unscrupulous and they want everybody to know when they raise their voice. But a judge who controls their courtroom is going to make sure that everybody does this in whispers, or he's going to excuse the jury and bring everybody to the bench to discuss this. So I don't think you have to worry about a special rule because I think judges are sensitive to these things. And I think that if a courtroom is run right, these issues are discussed up at bench privately out of the earshot of jurors. So no worries there.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. I, you know, one of the things that bothers me about this case and I did a lot of research, and the one thing that I couldn't find, if anybody out there listening today or in the future can find me anything in writing that talks about when it was that African-American men were not allowed to serve on juries. There was a time. I know there was a time. And because the story is, well, of course, we couldn't trust an African-American man to be behind closed doors with a white woman and not sexually attack her. You know, I mean, that was so ridiculous. But that argument, I'm sure, was used at some time. And I think that's what's being used against people on the registry as well. And in fact, it was a Riverside County Sheriff's Association or something like that. And when they made a comment, and I'm paraphrasing, folks, this is not a quote, but they made a comment that, well, people who are going to be on, you know, juries and things like that, well, they didn't agree to basically be in a locked room with a bunch of gangbangers. And that was before the exception for registrants. That was just, I'm sure they were even thinking about people, you know, who've been convicted of murder, people convicted of robbery, et cetera, you know. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so, this type of thinking is so ridiculous, and people just don't understand. But you know, people have certain beliefs, even if they're not supported by facts, let me put it that way. and they're not going to be, you know, they're not going to change their mind just because you bring up the facts. Okay, well, I appreciate that input about the jurors and stuff like that. And there's a comment over here that I really like from Douglas. It says, I believe that a jury for a sex crime should be a mix of registrants, their loved ones, and experts on the matter. I think that's, I totally agree with you, Douglas. That was a good comment. And Rafael, you've got your hand up.
Thank you. I just wanted to add something that has happened to me recently, quite repeatedly, which was astonishing. And it was something to do with deliveries. Because of our health condition, we subscribe to a meal delivery service. And apparently, once they look at my address in order to get directions to come to the house to deliver the food, they see or they find information about the house being inflicted, they stop coming. And it was just not one service, but there's been three different services. The cleaners, a delivery service. the cleaners were supposed to come into my house to clean, and they didn't come because mostly they were women, and the delivery service did not deliver the food. They didn't specify why, but they just said that they couldn't do it. Just want to bring that up.
Well, can I ask about the meal deliveries? Were any of them government organizations, or are we talking about like for profits?
It was one of those internet San Francisco based companies that start businesses, and this was area people that cook and then they deliver, and you sign up and you order your food ahead of time a week. And then they assign these chefs or this cook people to also be responsible to delivering the food to you.
Well, Rafael, I hope you'll call me next week, please, because I'd like to know more about this. If the government is involved at all, I'd love to see the government. I'm not sure we would have as much success if we filed a lawsuit against a privately owned company.
Yeah, no, there was no government involved. It was just a company.
It's like Grub something?
It's something like chef delivery food service.
Okay, well, call me during the week if you would so we can talk about it.
Thank you, Janice.
Surely. If anybody else has had an experience like that, please call me too. And let's see if this is just a one of... and this particular geographic area, or if it's happening all other places as well. I think that's very disturbing. I mean, if you're expecting food to be delivered to you and it doesn't show up, and they don't, especially if they don't notify you in advance, that could be really bad.
I think part of my problem is that I've been in the same area for 40 years, and over the 36 years that I've been on the registry, everybody and the dog poodle knows who I am and what I am. And though I have established myself as to I'm not going anywhere and I done my penalty, I still get new people that come into the area who are advised, informed, and then they still have that attitude of rejecting the association or my neighbors, for example. They don't pretty much speak to me. I get long faces. But I'm not going anywhere, and I think that's a byproduct of that incident, that you stay in some place for 37 years, everybody knows you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rafael.
Raphael, and I think this pertains to everybody. You know, this it's not just that, you know, you're a registrant or people know about you or anything like this. It's the whole damaged goods thing. Okay. What happens, and this is just, you know, on the outside, is once this tag is on you forever, no matter whether you are registered now or you get off the registry and you're trying to reintegrate, the stigma is still there. And the stigma says you're damaged goods, and so therefore you're capable of anything, usually bad. And, you know, no matter how hard you try and no matter how much good you do in terms of rehabilitation and all the rest, you're still going to meet at some juncture that stigma, and that could happen in so many different ways. And so part of our battle here is to break that myth, because it's a myth. There's nothing uniquely specialized about the particular crime or about monitoring. Okay. It just all gets so mixed up in the messages that, you know, we're getting as a community as to what it means. And it's up to us to make sure that we break that myth. And that's what part of our organizational mission is to break the myth. And so that those who are now on the registry can get off and reintegrate. And I think that this is a huge issue for all of us. You know, it's not just that we want to be treated fairly, but we really want the right to be forgotten, so that we can reintegrate with grace. And so thank you for bringing this up, because I think it's a really important point.
Yeah, in that respect, many times I almost felt like I wanted to be the guinea pig and sort of say, look, people, this was 37 years ago. I have done my time. I have done the remorse, the rehabilitation, the rebirth, I mean, you name it, resentfulness and so forth and so on. And when does anybody end this? What else can you do in order to clear your life? And not for my sake, but to say for the family around me who keeps being damaged and hurt.
Okay. So I think that one of the things you can do, and I think we're all strive to do, is live an upstanding life. I think that's number one and most important. And that is an example to all. This is the right way to go. I mean, if you weren't concerned about doing that, you wouldn't be grouping here talking with us and doing this thing today. I think that's a really important thing to do. So, and you know, we're slowly chipping at that paradigm, and we're making progress. We're making big progress, but it's just little chips at a time. And it may take a lifetime. It may not, but it's where we're headed. So just keep the hope, keep the faith, and support our efforts. I think we're getting there.
Look, well, I'm available to be a litigant if that ever happens. As you know, I have been clean for the 36 years. I have a certificate of rehabilitation already received, and I have no contact with the police since that incident 36 years ago. So I don't know what else I can do.
Yeah. Raphael, I want to acknowledge that you've paid your debt to society, and you know what you're experiencing now are these collateral consequences, which people haven't thought out. They haven't spent their time thinking about it. And it's just like this knee-jerk reaction. Oh my gosh, you're on the sex offender registry and you must be a monster. Chance and I know better. We know that's not who you are. It's just a label. Right. And so the whole reason that this organization even exists, and Chance, you talked about it for a moment, but I want to expand upon it. The whole reason that we exist is to, in fact, get your civil rights restored and also the rights of your family members. So as Raphael just mentioned, what's going on doesn't just affect him. I'm sure food not showing up doesn't affect just Raphael, but whoever else is living in the house with him. And so we understand that. We understand that, you know, there's this really awful ripple effect, and that, you know, when the government tells you you can't live somewhere, well, it affects you certainly, but also affects your family too, because they can't live there either. So I'm going to go on, because Ken, you've been so kind and so patient waiting with your hand up. You know, please unmute yourself and let us know what you want to say.
Yeah. Hi. You know, I feel for Rafael. It's like, I mean, I've had dinner over at the retired warden's house, one of the prisons that I did time at, and I worked for her, and she knew me very well. The thing that I was looking at, and the question I got is that, okay, I'm off parole. I know while I was on parole, I had police come by occasionally and see that I was in compliance with my registry. But now that I'm off parole, I've had them come up to my door and knock on it already. And it's just like what's been talked about here. It's like a big broadcast. Oh, somebody did, you know, somebody is here. And obviously that, you know, most people will go straight to the registry at that point. So are they legally permitted to just drop by and check and see if you're still living at the place that that you're registered at, or is it specifically the annual registry that you have to do enough?
Unfortunately, state law authorizes them to come by and check. And that's why I refer to it as a compliance check. They're seeing if in fact you live at that address. Just to let you know, when it comes to our state registry here in California, there are at least 9,000 people, so about almost 10% of the people on our registry who are, quote, in violation. And many of them, I believe, no longer live at the address that is on the profile. And so I'm sorry to say, Ken, that unfortunately they do have the right to come stop by. But remember what Chance and I were talking about earlier, that doesn't allow them to come search your home, okay?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So they can come and knock on the door.
Yes.
They can't search at home.
So the second question I have, I just want to make absolutely sure on this, that if my offense does not involve a minor, there are no restrictions for my travel at all out of country.
Well, the International Megan's Law doesn't apply to you. Right.
Okay.
But that's not to say that the regulations may compel you to give 21 days notice, and that's an issue, and we just haven't figured that out yet, and I think it's safe to say that if you're going to travel, comply with the 21 days notice until further word as to where that all falls, and you know, keep your eye on this litigation.
And folks, it's not just Chance and I who are confused. Our California Department of Justice is confused. And what I mean by that is the Department of Justice actually created a form. It's a form. It's an official government form for international travel, right? And then they say, honest to God, in their answers to frequently asked questions, we don't know if you have to fill this out or not. But just in case you do, we created a form. So that's how confusing and confused this is.
So, you know, one more point. I worked on the San Quentin newspaper. You should submit some of your things to them for publication, and they will do it.
Hmm. Well, send me a link or whatever, Chance and I both. We can start doing that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, yeah. Great.
Thank you.
All right. So I think we're at the point in time to talk about the tiered registry law here in California. So let's give a little bit of background information about it. Chance and I and many other people lobbied our state legislature here in Sacramento for about 7 years, saying this is wrong and not everybody on the registry should be monitored for the same length of time, et cetera. In fact, quite frankly, Chance and I both know that registries are not effective at all. But, you know, that's really too steep a mountain to climb in any one time. So as Chance was talking about before, about chipping away, chip, chip, chip away, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm a little termite, or I don't know, you know, chipping away at the laws here. And to put it in more lawyerly language, it's an incremental approach, okay? So we're taking an incremental approach to basically chipping away so much of the foundation that the whole damn thing collapses in of its own weight. I can't wait for that day to happen. I hope it happens during my lifetime. So we can't make any promises. But the fact is, one of the ways that we're chipping away is that we went to the state legislature and we actively lobbied for almost 7 years to get a tiered registry law. We did not get the tiered registry law we asked for. The legislative process is very imprecise, and there's a lot of compromises made along the way. I'm a former congressional staffer. I lived in Washington, D.C. I worked for the House of Representatives, and I'll tell you what, talk about imprecise, right? The legislative processes, I saw it with my own eyes, and I really couldn't stand it. So they talk about, you know, the making of laws is like the making of sausages, and I just didn't have the stomach. Tough enough stomach to stand it more than a couple of years. But here we are on the outside, and we went to the state legislature and we said, this is what we want. We want a tiered registry law that is based upon a person's current risk. What is a current risk that they pose to society? Thinking, of course, that most people don't pose a current risk at all, and they could just get up, be taken off the registry right away. Well, we didn't get that kind of tiered registry. The tiered registry we got instead was a registry that's based upon your conviction offense. Think about that, your conviction offense. Not how long ago did the conviction occur, et cetera. Okay, so the conviction offense. And there was a time, an early draft of the bill, Frank Lindsay, who I like to refer to a lot because I know his situation so well. And remember, he was convicted in 1979. And an early version of the tiered registry law would have let Frank and other people like him taken off the registry automatically, but it didn't happen. So the law changed, and there's many different iterations of the tiered registry law and the bill, rather, that finally came into law. And the law, not the bill, but the law says there's three tiers. Tier one, 10 years registration. Tier two, 20 years registration. Tier three, that's still lifetime registration. But think about it, before the tiered registry law, as imprecise as it is, before that, virtually everybody was on the registry for life. There were some people, but very few, who could get a certificate of rehabilitation that terminated their requirement to register. It was a very small percentage. I think it's probably about 1% of people on the registry, if not less. So all of a sudden, under the tiered registry law, a lot more people are eligible to petition for removal completely from the registry. We're not talking about getting off the Megan's Law website. Some people seem to be confused about, but if your petition is granted under the tiered registry law, you never have to register again in the state of California. That's huge. It's really, really huge. So the question is then about what tier have you been assigned to, right? And so I get calls a lot of time, and people, and a chance I'm sure you do too, and they don't know what their tier assignment is. Well, the California Department of Justice is the reason for most of that, but sometimes it's people just didn't ask. So if anybody is listening to this either in real time or later on, go to your registration office and ask, what is my tier assignment, okay? And even though the assignment is made by the Department of Justice, they're not going to tell you what your tier assignment is. You need to go to your registration office. So what the California Department of Justice did is they wrote a bunch of letters and they dumped them into a government-only database. And Chance, I don't know about you, but I really sincerely wish I could get access to that database, because then you wouldn't have to go to your registration office, because it's inconvenient, right? And sometimes you have to get an appointment and blah, blah, blah. And sometimes you get there and they're too lazy to look in their own database. But fact is, Chance and I don't have access to that because we're private attorneys, but the government does, including your registration office. So they can tell you the tier to which you've been assigned. Remember, tier one, 10 years. Tier two, 20 years. Tier three, lifetime, unless, and there's a small exception there, and I'm not going to talk about it because too many people will get confused. Okay, so, and what do we mean by the number of years? It starts when you're released from custody. Okay, so whenever you get out of jail or prison, the clock starts ticking forward. Okay, there's some things that can stop the clock, and there's some things that can move you backwards, or another way to put it, add more time. So let's just say you're assigned to tier one. There's 10 years registration required, right? But you get a failure to register. Okay, if you get a failure to register, that's going to add time. So if you have a misdemeanor offense, and you're on tier one, and you're convicted of a failure to register, it's not 10 years, but 11 years before you're eligible to petition, okay? If you were convicted of a felony, by the way, each failure to register is an additional 3 years. So, but most of the time, you know, Chance and I and other lawyers, we can figure this out for you. But guess what? Our opinion doesn't go very far. If the Department of Justice assigns you to tier three, no matter what Chance and I say, almost, it doesn't make any difference. I have argued successfully in a couple of cases with the California Department of Justice and said, this person doesn't belong on tier three, and let me tell you why. And both of those cases, actually all three of those cases, involved child pornography. And it was somebody who was convicted of a misdemeanor sex offense, or they had a felony that was reduced to a misdemeanor offense, which should put you in tier one, the lowest tier, and take you out of tier three, the highest tier. So that has been done in some cases. I don't know what their other factors are, Chance. I hesitate to say it, but I'm going to say it anyway, since it's being recorded. I think they use the dartboard. Uh-huh. I was like, we can make the best argument we can about this person belongs on tier three. Does not belong on tier three. They belong on tier one. And they go, eh. And then the question is, what do you do about that?
Okay. Well, you know, the interesting part about that is we're actually more effective in doing that than the prosecutors are saying that, look, you know, this belongs up in tier three, even though it's a tier one or tier two. And it's funny because you ask a prosecutor and they'll tell you the DOJ doesn't listen to us at all. They won't even consider what we say. However, you know, at least, you know, Janice and I and other attorneys who challenge tier three sometimes get some play on it because we're right. So, you know, that's the difference there.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the problems is that there are four groups of people whose tiers probably have not been assigned. Case number one, people who are convicted out of state, so not in California, but another state, you move to California, you're required to register in California, and yet your tier may not have been assigned. I have had a couple clients who have been convicted out of state and they have gotten a tier assignment, but many people who were convicted out of state don't have a tier assignment yet. The second group of people is people convicted in military courts. And, you know, there is a difference in military courts and civilian courts and blah, blah, blah. So many people convicted in a military court have not gotten a tier assignment. Number three is people convicted in federal court. Okay, so there's some federal offenses. For some reason, the California Department of Justice seems confused about this. Like, what? It hasn't changed. CP possession is CP possession, for example. I don't get it why there would be a delay, but a lot of people are being delayed in their tier assignments. And the fourth is people who are convicted a long time ago. So here goes Frank Lindsay again, right? Convicted in 1979. He's never been convicted of anything before or after that. And he doesn't have a tier assignment. I could have told, you know, if they would only listen to me, I would have told them on day one what Frank's tier assignment should be. He should be in tier two. But guess what? They haven't assigned his tier yet. And because of that, his petition was, in fact, rejected because he didn't have a tier assignment. So the California Department of Justice, the way that I read the tiered registry law, their deadline for assigning everybody to a tier is December 31st of this year, which means by January 1 of next year, every tier should be assigned. And guess what? If they're not assigned, we are suing them. So you can write that on your calendar. I think it's a holiday, so we can't file a lawsuit on January 1. But as soon as we can after that, we will be filing a lawsuit against the California Department of Justice for failing to meet their statutory requirement. Now, I've heard a rumor out there, and maybe you all have heard the same rumor, which is the California Department of Justice is interpreting their requirement in a different way. They think they have until June 30th of next year, not December 31st of this year, but until June 30th of next year. How in the heck they got to that interpretation, I have no clue. But we don't agree with them, and we will be suing them in January of next year if they don't have everybody's tier assigned. And I'll tell you what, Frank Lindsay is going to be Exhibit A. Again, the poor man was convicted in 1979. They can go get his court records. He was convicted in Orange County. I have a copy of his court records that I got from Orange County. How come the California Department of Justice can't get his court records? It just makes no sense to me. Chance, would you like to take it from there?
Well, yeah, I'm just going to make a comment here that, you know, the real issue sometimes in TBDs is not necessarily that we can't determine on the record what they are. We can, because we simply can use the DOJ criminal history to verify that, you know, it is what it is. The problem arises sometimes with out of state or out of jurisdiction convictions, or out of jurisdiction convictions, usually an out of state conviction qualifies for relief here possibly, but is TBD because they, because of one reason or another. But that's an issue because we can't just look at a California criminal history because it's not on it. It's on a criminal history in some other state. It's hard to make that comparison. But when all the cards are on the table and the DA, the judge, and, you know, the defense attorney can all sit down and have an intelligent conversation on what that shows, we don't really need the DOJ to stick their nose into it if they can't figure it out by now. And that's really the simple process to that. And I suspect, and Janice brought up an interesting issue, which is, you know, why the heck do they have to wait until June 30th? Well, because they're relying on the fact that this party got started July 1st, you know, so they think that they got the extra time. So what happens between, say, the 1st and the 30th of June? Well, we're all going to just have to go to the record and look at it and make determinations without the Department of Justice, while, on the other hand, we sue. And I think that, you know, because the party doesn't stop because DOJ says it does, there's this thing called law. And the law says that they got 24 months, and 24 months is 24 months. That's just plain and simple. As for for everything else, that doesn't stop either. People need to be able to get their time to process through this thing and get off the registry if it is due them. And I think it's perfectly logical that if you can make this out from the record at hand, you don't need a DOJ designation. And I've already been successful at doing this, at least in one jurisdiction, and trying to do this in other jurisdictions, not getting a summary denial. So, and I don't mean jurisdiction, I mean in different courts in Los Angeles basin particularly. So, you know, I know it's possible because I've accomplished that with the judge and the DA. I think it's possible to do that. So my take on this is that we're moving in a positive direction, and I think that a lawsuit is warranted if they can't come up with what they say. I mean, look, they're sending out notices to everybody that they're not going to, you know, that they're not going to be excluded from this, and that they've got plenty of time to research all of that. Okay, they've got plenty of time to send out notices that say that as of a certain date you're going to be on Megan's Law and all the rest because the laws change. How come they can't do TBDs? That should be first priority. And so,
you have a chance. What this reminds me of, remember when we sued them a few years ago? So, you know, and I have to tell you, even Chance and I are really brave, courageous lawyers. But when you're going to sue a whole agency full of lawyers, you know, it takes some guts, let me tell you. And so we got our gumption and we filed a lawsuit against the California Department of Justice because they were refusing to add people information on people's profiles. That was really important. And that information was when a person was released. So they had the year of conviction, but they didn't have the year of release. Now, sometimes they didn't even have the year of conviction. Sorry. They didn't have either one of them. Yet there was a law that said they were supposed to have both pieces of information by a certain date. At least we had that law behind us. So, and there was a very prominent attorney who worked for that agency who told me point blank, she said, oh, you know, it's going to take us 7 years to get around to this. And I'm saying, I knew more than 90% of the profiles lacked this information. And the reason I knew that is every time somebody calls me for the first time, I look you up your profile on the Megan Saw website and I tell you what's on it because you can't look at your own profile, right? And want to make sure that it's correct. And 90% of the time, at least, that information was missing. So I said to her, you know, this needs to be done. It needs to be added. She's, oh, no, we just don't have the resources. It's going to take us at least 7 years to add that information to people's profiles. 7 years, right? So we sued them. And you know what happened? 6 months. It took them 6 months to fix the profiles. Well, not 7 years. It took them 6 months.
The magic, I think, in the whole thing was they thought they could invite us to the Department of the DOJ and sit us down with their staff attorneys and explain to us why the problem was. And what we did is when we got invited in, we just kind of gave them a preview of what the trial was going to look like. And magic, everything kind of worked out very quickly.
All of a sudden, they had all the resources they needed. So anyway, if we file a lawsuit in January of next year, which is what I'm predicting we're going to be doing, and we'll have it all ready to go, you know what? It will just nudge them forward and get them to do what they need to do. Because I'm afraid, even if they think their deadline is June 30th of next year, they're not going to meet that deadline either. And folks, let me tell you, I have no sympathy for the California Department of Justice, and these are the reasons why. Number one, this law was passed in 2017. That's 5 years ago, okay? They had 4 years between the time it was passed until the petitioning process started. They had over 4 years to assign people's tiers, 4 years. Number two, they were authorized 60 new positions in the agency to do just this, 60. Can you imagine what you could do with 60 people over a four-year period? They haven't done it, right? So I don't have any sympathy for these folks. And if they're a bunch of bureaucrats and they can't get out of their own way, it's not our problem. It's their problem. So they had 5 years, 4 years rather, and 60 people, and they should have done what needed to be done. And they didn't do it. Oh, well. So I want to build on a comment that Chance made too about good news. So a lot of petitions are being granted now, folks. I just want you to know that. And I will tell you, I am so shocked at two counties in particular. One of them is Alameda County. I'm getting petitions granted in two months on a week or something like that. I'm shocked at how quickly Alameda County is responding. And the other one, that's quite surprising me is Ventura County. Ventura County, in my experience, has not been friendly to registrants, but they're getting petitions done in 3 months. Now, there's other counties on the other end of the spectrum, right? And so there's some counties where it's dragging out to 6 months. The worst I've had is 9 months. And this poor man, it was an LA County case, Chance, the court lost his petition. It was just lost in the system, and they didn't have it. I mean, everybody, and I'm working with the DA's office, they were having trouble finding the petition. Everybody was having trouble finding the petition. When they finally found the petition, they just granted it. There was no hearing or nothing. They just granted it.
It's amazing. Jurisdictions that were, but you have to remember, when you're asking for a certificate of rehabilitation, you're asking a court to declare a person rehabilitated. And that is why, it's just like a trickle. But here, it's a different process. Removal is not a declaration, it's removal. But you would think that those jurisdictions that were so hesitant to at least declare someone rehabilitated, because it might relieve them of the requirement to register, now is processing registry petitions so quickly. I'm amazed at two jurisdictions. One is Riverside, who has always been very, very tough. And the other is Orange County, both of which are moving right along. It's been my experience now that they are processing. Not that there's some resistance, not that there's some snafus here and there. And that happens in every jurisdiction. But I'm pretty amazed that those two in particular are moving, and I'm happy about that.
As am I. And I don't know if you all are familiar with Pat Benatar's song about "Hit Me with Your Best Shot." There's a line in there about put another notch in my lipstick case. I have 24 notches on mine. I've gotten 24 people off the registry under the tiered registry law so far, and I got room for more. So I'm so absolutely delighted. I feel like every person who gets off the registry is like a slave that's been released from a plantation. I really feel that way. And so I am so happy to be able to help people off the registry. And I know, Chance, you are too.
Well, I've been successful in that way too. And when I did certificates, it was a harder game and, just much more difficult in terms of issues that came up. But this is running well, and I've been very successful at doing these, and I'm very happy because they should be granted. They absolutely should be granted, and they are getting granted.
Of the 24 that I've gotten granted so far, only one of them was there a hearing on the merits. And it was in Placer County up here in Northern California. And the DA's office objected to the petition and asked the judge to continue this man's registration. in order to significantly enhance community safety. That's a language from the law, by the way. They didn't come up with it. And I will tell you, I've never been so happy as to see the judge's decision. And one particular sentence in the decision that said the DA did not meet his burden of proof. In other words, the DA could not prove to the judge that community safety would be significantly enhanced by requiring this man to continue registering. He'd already been registering over 25 years. He was a tier two, been assigned a tier two. And the judge said, I'm not going to do that. So
you know, what it's really coming down to is, as Janice said, you know, it's a conviction oriented way of doing things, which is what we fought so vehemently against. But what it's really coming down to is risk. At the end of the day, that's what a hearing's all about. I mean, if they're saying community safety standards, we're talking risk. And so even though it's conviction based, you know, the bend is that the real issue is risk. And this is just fantastic. So congratulations on that. That's very, very cool.
Yeah, thank you. BJW, you had your hand up. Maybe it's not up anymore. Maybe that was a mistake. Folks, this is the time to ask Chance and I any questions that you might have about the petitioning process. You know, if you can make it more generic, that would be better. If it's a specific question, we might ask you to call us during the week. But this is the time, again, about the tiered registry law. And if you have a question, maybe you have a comment. Maybe you've gone through the process. I know at least one of my clients is on right now, actually two of them, who might have a comment to make, maybe three of them, accounting here, and such, and just say, you know, I'm encouraged by the success in the number of petitions that are being granted. What I'm not encouraged by is the following. Not enough people have filed their petitions. And I don't know why. I don't know if people are just on the sidelines and waiting to see what happens to the other people on the playing field here before they submit their petitions. But a lot of people, a lot more people are eligible than are, in fact, filing their petitions. Actually, my best guess is there should be at least 40,000 people who should have applied for a petition by now because they were convicted of Penal Code Section 288A. That's a tier two offense. And it only requires 20 years of registration, right? But if you're on parole, probation, or supervised release, you're not eligible until you get off of parole, probation, or supervised release, even if it's for another type of offense. I've answered that question several times, Chance, in calls. I assume that you have as well. And get this, I even got the question, well, I'm in custody. Can I apply now to get removed from the registry? And the answer is no. Okay, even though the person was in custody, it was a family member, the person's in custody for something that's not a sex offense and a really old sex offense. I wish I could have helped that person, but I can't. So if you're in custody, no. If you're on paper, no. Okay. But a lot of other people who are eligible, I think, have not filed a petition for one reason or another. So please do so. Chance and I put together a tutorial. Gosh, Chance, it was over a year ago. We put together a tutorial. It's still available on the Axol website. It tells you how to fill out the forms. I will tell you, filling out the forms is not the hard part. But, you know, so if you think you can fill out the form, great. You have to do a lot of service and you have to get that exactly right or, you know, your petition gets rejected. So it probably is better if you can get an attorney's help. And then, my goodness, if you ever file a petition, anybody, and your petition is rejected, if the DA objects to your petition, you need a lawyer. Don't go to court without a lawyer because you will get chopped up in little bitty pieces and thrown out in the trash can. You really need a lawyer. It's an evidentiary hearing, potentially. Briefs have to be written. My brief in the case that I mentioned where the judge said the DA did not meet his burden of proof, it was a 30-page brief. And we're talking about the law. In addition to my brief, by the way, there was also a psych eval done by a PhD psychologist. And the reason, folks, that we file these briefs and we have the psych evals is we're actually giving the judge a shield. So the judge can hide behind this and go, well, look, here's a PhD psychologist who says this person poses a very low risk of offense or a low risk of offense. We need to arm our judges accordingly. Now, Scott, I see that you've got your hand up. Let me ask you to unmute yourself. I'm sure he'll do that in just a moment here.
Yeah.
There you go.
Very good. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
I just wanted to take this opportunity again to thank Janice. I was a Tier 1 registrant here in Ventura County. And our county was pretty proactive once the tiered registry came out. And they were actually suggesting to use the local public defender. But after looking into this a little bit more, I contacted Janice, and I can tell you, it was the most comfortable thing to go through. It was fairly successful. We got results back in 2.5 months. But the big thing is just the level of comfort that one goes through by using somebody who has experience. I first contacted a local criminal defense lawyer, and I was actually having to explain to them what SB 384 was. And that doesn't build up a lot of confidence. So I was glad I found the AXOL website. And after looking at the instructions on how to go through the Tier 1 paperwork on your own, I can tell you nothing beats having an experienced lawyer behind you. So again, thank you very much. And if anybody's sitting on the fence, I would tell you, go with someone who has experience in this matter. And it made a world of difference.
Thank you, Scott, for that testimonial. It was, I believe yours was the first petition I filed in Ventura, and I was surprised at how quickly that they did it. But I've had other ones since then, and they've all been that quick. As I said earlier, County is not known to be kind to registrants, and so it was quite a pleasant surprise that they're able. And, you know, the chance and I have encountered, I'll just say on the other end of the spectrum, Los Angeles County, it's just totally bizarre what's going on because – in the good old days, right, Chance, when we had certificates of rehabilitation, there was one courtroom, there was one judge who heard all the certificates of rehabilitation. Now, with these petitions are being farmed out to courtrooms here, there, and everywhere, judges who don't know Senate Bill 384, the tiered registry law, district attorneys who don't know the tiered registry law, I mean, all kinds of bizarre results are happening. In some cases, you know, to Chance's credit, he talked one of those courts into granting the petition, even though the tier hadn't been assigned yet, which I think is absolutely the proper thing to have done. But there's other courts in LA that are just causing problems. And I had a problem with one court in LA County where, of all people, it was the clerk's problem. So the judge granted the petition during the hearing. It took the clerk 3 months to get me a copy of the order. 3 months, and she had one excuse after the other. And I got so close to calling her boss, the judge, and telling, you know, a tale about her, but I decided not to because of concern about future retaliation possibly. So I just lived with it, but it's really my client who had to live with it. So for 3 months, he did not get taken off the registry because it took 3 months to get a signed order.
Yeah, you know, there is a lot of resistance out there. And across the state, I do these all over the state. The funny thing is that, you know, when you got a pocket of resistance, it usually stays that way. But in my experience, it's not. Actually, I've made a lot of friends here, a lot of friends with court staffs, with clerks, with DA's offices. I'm amazed. It's just amazing. I never expected that. I really expected this to be so stressful. But, you know, it's less stressful today. And I think as you get into it, the more you deal with it and the more you understand the nuances, it lifts the stress. That's not to say that there are going to be cases that are controversial or they're not or involve issues that need to be litigated, maybe. And those are complex cases. And, you know, those are cases that will go to hearing. But as the process starts to set in, there's, you know, especially in LA County, there's still a lot of confusion. And for the reasons that Janice says, a lot of, you know, it's not like one unit's taken care of and it's happening in one court. And so
there's still a lot to work out. And I think it's going to take a period of years before we really smooth things out straight across the board in California.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was reminded in the chat room here about it, mentioning some cases. We do have 3 cases pending, folks, that challenge different provisions of the tiered registry law. So we've asked the legislature, Chance and I and the organization, we've been up here to Sacramento lobbying and trying to improve upon the tiered registry law. The tiered registry law, the fact that we have one is better than not having one. On the other hand, there's plenty of improvement that could be made. One of the improvements in the most recent lawsuit that was filed, if on behalf of 2 people, and one of them is in fact on the call today, and so if he wants to speak up, certainly welcome to do that, but you don't have to. And it has to do with the California Department of Justice assigning people to Tier 3 for an attempted offense, an attempt. So in other words, whatever the underlying conduct was, it wasn't completed. It was an attempt to do something. And they're being assigned to Tier 3, and it's just wrong. So we filed a lawsuit, and that lawsuit was filed recently on June 30th and was filed in Los Angeles Superior Court. We had 2 cases already that were pending, and one of them had to do with people convicted of 288.2. Interesting case about a situation there is we believe that anybody who's had a 288.2 that either was a misdemeanor to begin with or was reduced to a misdemeanor, they shouldn't be required to register at all. And guess what? DOJ is assigning them to Tier 3. So that was the second case that we filed. The first case we filed has to do with people convicted of Penal Code Section 288C, and that's lewd or lascivious acts of somebody who was 14 or 15. And the reason for that one is that people convicted basically of the same conduct, but with a younger victim are assigned to Tier 2, and yet people convicted of 288(c) are being assigned to Tier 3. What? That makes absolutely no sense. So that case, the 288(c) case, we already the judge granted a motion, a demurrer, which is like a motion to dismiss in that case, because the trial court judge didn't want to make a difficult decision. So she said, I grant the demurrer, you know, and didn't tell us to take it up on appeal, but we have taken it up on appeal. And so we're waiting in that case. Actually, our opening brief is due on September 3rd. And so it's one of those equal protection claims. Remember when I talked about the juror's case and how that legal claim had to do with equal protection? This case as well. And so, again, we're hoping for victory in the juror's case so that we can use that equal protection case to help us in the 288C case. So we're doing what we need to do to improve the tiered registry law, right? It's not a perfect law by any stretch of the imagination. And we'll also be lobbying again for these improvements in early 2023. So we'll let you know about opportunities to come to Sacramento and to lobby our legislators to fix this. We were told not to come, to take a break. It happened to kind of be coincide with the pandemic anyway, but to take a break for 2 years, let the law go into effect, and let's see how things work out here. And then if there are some improvements, they promised that they would listen to us. Not necessarily that they'd make the changes that we requested, but at least that we would listen to them. So I think that's about all I have to say. Chance, how about you as far as the tiered registry law?
I'm good.
Okay. All right. So folks, I really appreciate the fact that you're here today. This meeting is recorded. If you really need to listen to it again, you'll be able to do it. There should be a link on the AXAW website later today. If Chance and I have told you, or your fellow registrants here have told you anything that's of value, or if you want to continue these monthly meetings, please consider making a donation. So the organization exists on donations. We've applied for several grants and never been given one because they say, ooh, you icky people, we're not giving you a grant. But anyway, if you'd be kind enough to make a donation, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you, everybody. Looking forward to seeing you next month.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.